This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in June.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Laura Tohe is a poet, writer, librettist, scholar of Indigenous American literature, former Navajo Nation poet laureate. She holds a doctorate degree in creative writing, Indigenous American literature, and American literature, and is professor emerita at Arizona State University. Her books include No Pearl Today, about her experiences in a boarding school, and Code Talker Stories, an oral history book with the remaining Navajo Code Talkers. And she wrote the libretto for Enemy Slayer, a Navajo oratorio. And Laura Tohe joins us. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Good morning. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. Very good. So I want to get a bit of your background, very interesting background. You grew up in a pretty small town, right, on the Navajo Reservation, about 300 people, I understand.
Yes, it was a small community called Crystal on the Navajo Nation, near the border of Arizona. This little town was just a beautiful little place, much like the beauty here in Springdale. We had no phones or television or newspapers in our home. We had only a radio, so we got to listen to that. And because of that, I liked to read. After I learned at the boarding school that I walked to every day, it was called actually a day school. I didn't actually live at the boarding school, but I walked to the school every day and learned how to read very quickly, and I was a tutor for my classmates, and it was from that learning to read, I learned how to put sounds and words together. So it was very easy for me, and I loved reading from that point on, and fortunately my mother saw that in me, and she took me to Gallup, New Mexico, which is about 40, 50 miles away, to get a library card at the Gallup library, and I was able to check out lots of books.
It's a lifeline for a lot of children, I think, right? That library card. So what did you read?
Well, I read fairy tales. I read Russian fairy tales, the Baba Yaga fairy tales. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but about this witch who was so evil that her house stood on chicken legs. You know, that just fascinated me because I was growing up in this little community, and books enabled me to go to other places and read about people there and the things that they did. So I read those stories, and I also read Little Madeline, and later on, I started to read the Nancy Drew series, which I also loved very much. And my brothers had comic books that they allowed me to read sometimes, as long as I didn't get my fingerprints over everything. So I learned to read Superman and Batman and, you know, all those superhero stories that used to be available in the comic books.
Tell me about storytelling in your community. Very important, right?
Yes, very important. My mother had lots of stories from when she was growing up and being raised by her great-grandmother. Those are the stories that she told us in the car, which I called car stories. Mm. And we would be in the car driving to Gallup or to visit relatives, and she would turn the radio off. And she would tell us these stories. And one of them was a story about two human children that transformed into prairie dogs due to their parents' neglect. That story fascinated me, and it stayed with me my whole life. And when I got to the University of New Mexico, I took a class with Rudy Anaya, and he assigned us a story to write that began with Once Upon a Time. That's the story I wrote, and it was eventually published. But the thing about growing up with people from my family and my extended family is that everyone was a storyteller. I didn't realize that until I was in college when I took this class with Rudy Anaya, and we were talking about stories, and he said that he writes stories about his community. And he said that, why don't you write some stories about your community? And that just was an epiphany for me, because when I started to think about when we'd go visit family, it was always story time about what happened, who they saw, what animal was on the road, you know, all these things they would tell. And it just really made an impression on me that I was surrounded by stories all this time. And I didn't know that. I felt only white people had stories and wrote them. And after he told me that, I started thinking about what it was like when I was growing up. And it was true. I was always surrounded by stories, in the car, at home. People would, when they would visit, they always had some stories to tell. And when we'd have story time with my Navajo relatives that didn't speak English or very much English, they would sit and listen, and they would say, you know, this, which really meant, yes, I'm listening, go on, I'm interested. And the storyteller would continue on. And then that story would end, and then the next person would tell a story. And that's the way it always was for me growing up, and that influenced what I wrote later on. I was very much influenced by the oral tradition of my family, and that helped me begin my journey as a writer when I started writing these stories and remembering some of these stories and putting them on paper and eventually getting them published. So I owe a great debt of gratitude to the family, to my family who surrounded me and gave me this gift of storytelling.
You said you have said the Diné people, like many Indigenous peoples, have always had a great reverence for language, for sacred words, how they're used in meditations. I wonder if you'd talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes. I think our oral tradition encompasses also the sacred language that we use in ceremonies. When we have ceremonies, there are songs and prayers recited within a sacred space during the ceremony. For example, if there's a healing ceremony taking place, there are certain songs that are sung over the patient by the medicine man and the people that he brings to the ceremony. Sometimes it's an apprentice, but we sit in this space and we sing these songs. And even if you don't really know the song, you can kind of pick some of the words up like I do. And because there's a lot of repetition in these songs. And so we sit there and we'll sing over the patient. And the purpose of that is to come together communally and to sing these songs and prayers for the patient, for their wellness, and to let them know that we are a community, that we are thinking for the well-being of the patient, which is usually a family member, that we love our relative and we want them to get better. So using language is a way of healing a patient, or, you know, in a ceremony, it's a way of healing. And that, I think, is very important for us, because we don't want to take that sacred language out of that that sacred space. So we're very protective of that. Mm. But yes, I think that Navajo people have a great reverence for language and purpose, and what you do with language and how you speak also tells a lot about how you were raised. So those are very important for us. And then we also have other language outside of the sacred space, you know, jokes and stories and which are also used to build community, like when we tell jokes or we tease someone, you know, that's all part of this coming together as a community and embracing one another through language. And now I think with poetry, we're taking language in a new direction for us, because we, even though we had poetry through the medicine men's songs and prayers, we did not have a written tradition like the Western cultures did. So this is a new artistic expression for us to write poetry and to publish it and to recite it in public. So that's all part of what I'm doing now, and I have been doing this for many years.
How did you decide to become a poet? When did you discover, poetry and Navajo poetry, and how did you decide to become a poet?
I never even knew what poetry was until I think I was in high school. I'd heard stories. I didn't know what a poem was, and I think in my English class, we must have read some stories or some poems. But not until I got to college, I took an English class, and we read poetry. And it was quite different than telling stories. I also went to poetry readings by some of the early Native poets who were publishing and writing during the 60s and 70s, people like Simon Ortiz and Leslie Silko and Joy Harjo used to come to the university and read their poetry. I was very much touched and moved by their poetry because, for one thing, this is the first time they were writing about what their existence in the world. They were writing about their community. They were writing about things of the earth. They were writing about things that I learned when I was growing up. But I never had that literature in my life until I got to college. And one of the poets wrote about injustice, which I had seen in the border towns where I grew up. I'd seen it most of my life. And that also made a deep impression on me. And I thought, if I could write like these poets, maybe I could make a difference. Maybe I could be a writer. Maybe I could be a poet. And so I started writing in secret. I was a closet poet for a while. I did show a few poems to one of my instructors, and nothing really came of it. And I just put it away for years until I graduated and got my undergrad. And then I started writing again because another friend was also writing poetry. So that was when I decided, you know, this is something I can do. This is something that I can express, and I can make myself visible, and I can make Navajo literature visible. You know, these were things that I felt were important to me as a writer. And so I wrote, and the first time I was asked to do a poetry reading, I was scared to death. And realize that this is something that one does as a poet, that you are asked to read a poem in public. So I think those early experiences of wanting to give visibility, wanting to have this literature coming from me and my family and my community is what I think helped me to understand that language is important, poetry is important. It can make differences in my life and in other people's lives. And I didn't really think a lot about the latter part, but I felt that if the poets that I had listened to had that effect on me, maybe my work could have an effect on an audience as well. So I think that's been a long journey for me, using words, and it's taken me in so many wonderful paths in my life.
You generally write your poems in Navajo and English, I think, right? When you perform them, do you read them in both?
Yes. It depends on my audience. If I have a mostly Navajo audience or an indigenous audience, I feel I can read these poems in Navajo and English. And sometimes I might have an audience that is not familiar with the language and doesn't really know much about indigenous people. So I try to include some of that sometimes, and sometimes I don't. It's just sometimes I have to read my audience. But I do feel it's important for me to write in my native language because we are losing it. I took 2 summers of Navajo literacy at the Met College in Salie, Arizona, because I felt it was important for me as a writer to know how to read and write my own language. So I did that. And I'm glad I did, because I was taught Navajo when I was growing up. It was actually my first language, but I didn't learn how to read it until many years later. And I think writing in my own language is so much different than writing in English, because first of all, the Navajo language is very poetic, and I can draw on that sense of poetry that's built into the language, in the worldview, in images, in the way people speak, and use that in my own work. So that has been one of the ways I've became a poet, was first of all thinking about something in Navajo and then translating it into English and then writing it down. But yeah, I try to retain my language. I try to write things in Navajo. Hopefully the next generation will have these poems that they can read and know that someone wrote these works with them in mind, including my little granddaughter, who's just 3 years old. And that was my thinking when I wrote Code Talker stories, in which I interviewed 20 of the last Code Talkers that were still living at that time. And many of them code switch. They used Navajo and English. Some gave their stories only in English and some only in Navajo, but everything was translated. And if it was written in Navajo, all that was written like the way they spoke it, but it was also translated into English. So the next generation, or this generation, would be able to read these stories of the Code Talkers.
Let's take a quick break, and then I want to talk about Code Talkers and also have you read some of your poems for us. We're talking with Laura Tohi today on the program. She's a poet, writer, librettist, scholar of Indigenous American literature, former Navajo Nation poet laureate. We'll have more with Laura Tohi following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Laura Tohi on the program today. She's a poet, writer, librettist, scholar of Indigenous American literature, former Navajo Nation poet laureate. So, Laura Tohi, you mentioned one of your books, Navajo Code Talkers. You were, I think, asked to record stories of the Code Talkers. Your father had been a Code Talker, right?
Yes, that's right.
So one of the things that stood out to me, and I'll have you, you know, tell me a little bit about this. I was reading kind of the introduction to the book, and you said that you had some prepared questions that you would ask some of these veterans, and that didn't work so well. And then you hit upon this idea, well, I'll just ask them to tell me a Code Talker story. And they would tell stories, and that was more natural for them.
Yes, I had this long list of questions on a notebook, and I went to visit the Code Talker, the families and the Code Talker, and I started asking them these questions, and it was responded with yes or no, or yes, I did that, and that was it. And I couldn't draw out the story from them until I realized, you know, there's, like me, we're all storytellers. So I asked them, can you tell me a story about, well, first of all, I had to introduce myself to them in Navajo and let them know that my father was a Code Talker, and that way they would know who I am, that I wasn't just someone coming from the outside and wanting to take these stories from them and never respond afterwards, because they said sometimes that happened to them. So I introduced myself, and then I asked them, can you tell me a story about being a Code Talker? And that's all I said. And off they went for hours sometimes. One Code Talker told me stories for 2 days in his orchard. And each of the Code Talkers, except for that one that talked for 2 days, I recorded so that I would have this oral record, and I also filmed them, so I'd have that as well. But they were all very much stories about before they entered service and when they entered service and some of the battles that they fought in, and then what happened to them after they came back. And because my father passed in 1994, I didn't get to hear his stories about being a Code Talker. I only heard little snippets from him or from my brother. But I learned a great deal from the Code Talkers as far as what my father did and some of the places he went, the battles he fought in. And in that way, I learned about what he went through when he enlisted at the age of 16. And according to the military records, he wasn't discharged until 1946, a year after the war ended, World War II. So that was interesting to me, and I was very, very happy to fill in some of these spaces that my father didn't tell me. But I was able to interview 20 of the Code Talkers who were living at that time, and that was in 2005 through 2011. I went out to the Navajo Nation homeland in Arizona, New Mexico, and into southern Utah, and interviewed the Code Talkers. Sometimes it was maybe an hour, sometimes it was like a whole day. And but every one of these stories were very interesting because of the things that they went through, not only as soldiers, but as Navajo men who were sometimes belittled while they were in service. Sometimes they felt like they weren't being used the way that they were trained to use the code. They were called chief, which they didn't like, but they couldn't say anything to their commanding officers. But overall, I was very much, I was very proud to know that my father and that generation of Navajo men put themselves aside to give service to the United States, despite colonization, despite the boarding schools and the taking of their language, our language, the Navajo language, and they were willing to lay down their lives to help this country. And that was one of the things that they mentioned, that they felt it was their responsibility, even though all this history preceded, they were willing to go into battle. And I was so moved by that as well. And each one of those co-talkers that I interviewed deserved a book on their own. I was not able to do that. I was only working with the group of co-talkers and some of the descendants.
Yeah, that's it's a cruel irony, isn't it? I guess they overcame that. This fact that in the boarding schools, other places, some forces wanted to suppress their language, but then they went and used their language in service of their country.
Yes, they did. And there were also other tribes that were asked to use their language as code during World War One and Two. The Navajo code talkers only fought in the South Pacific Islands. They did not go to Europe. But they were very much, they still remembered a lot of these battles. And I felt a little hesitant at first because I realized these were male stories. And as a female, I didn't feel that I should go into those male story spaces. But they were willing to tell me about the battles and what they saw, what they felt. And it was all very much this story that encompassed a whole group of men who were coming from mostly poverty, and but who actually were prepared to become soldiers because of their background. Coming from homes that had maybe little food sometimes, had very little money. Sometimes they had no shoes, like one of the code talkers mentioned. And then they went to these schools and they were told to not speak the Navajo language, not be who your identity is, you know, and that was to be erased as well. And they got in trouble or punished for speaking Navajo language. And so when they got into the military and they were selected to be code talkers, they were told, we want you to create a code using the Navajo language that we can use in battles. And they were astounded. They said, but we were told we couldn't speak the language, and now they want us to make a code. So that was something that very ironic for them, but they did it. They did it willingly, and I think it made a huge difference in the outcome of some of the battles in the South Pacific.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Laura Tohe. She is a poet, writer, librettist, scholar of Indigenous American literature, former Navajo Nation poet laureate, and she's at Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale through this week. Laura Tohe, I want to talk a bit about your book, No Parole Today. This is your experience at a boarding school. You said you didn't board there, but you attended, right? In the book, you talk a little bit about, I guess, the founder of these boarding schools, I guess the most famous one, Richard Henry Pratt, who founded the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. And in fact, I understand your great grandfather was one of the first students there. Richard Pratt famously wanted to stamp out Indian culture, right? Totally assimilate Indian students. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, his quote was, "Kill the Indian, save the man." I have to make a correction. When I lived at Crystal, New Mexico, I walked to the day school, and I lived at home, but because there weren't any schools other than the one I was attending nearby. My mother enrolled us at the Albuquerque Indian School. My brothers were there as well. And I lived on the campus of the Albuquerque Indian School and took a bus every day to the public school. So I did live in a military kind of institution, very much modeled after the first boarding schools that Richard Henry Pratt founded, because he fought in the Civil War, and he founded the Carlisle Institute in Pennsylvania. And from that model, in the 60s and 70s, maybe even part of the 80s, the Indian schools were still modeled after that early Richard Henry Pratt schools. And so I lived on a campus with in a dormitory. Maybe there were maybe 600 Navajo and Pueblo Apache students there. We lived in a dormitory that I think was a hospital at one time. And actually, they were condemned, I heard. But we lived in that, and I took a bus every day to the public school from when I was ninth grade into 12th grade. So I graduated from public school in Albuquerque. But I wrote about that in a book called No Parole Today, what it was like from a young girl's point of view to be in that kind of institution. And that was the first book that I, full-length book that I published.
You have a very interesting poem based on Dick and Jane, right? Those the famous books. Dick and Jane Subdue the Dine is the name of this poem. And of course, people, maybe today people aren't familiar with Dick and Jane, but, you know, see Dick and Jane run, that and they're always going, oh, 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 you know, that kind of thing. Tell me about this poem.
Okay. This poem was, I think it started out when I decided I was going to write a book on the boarding school. And I think what made me think about this boarding school was the books that I learned how to read from, which were the Dick and Jane reading series that came out, I think, in the 30s, maybe 40s. Those were the textbooks that the boarding school had, and they were about a white family, mother, father, and then the children, Dick, Jane, and Sally, and then they had a dog and a teddy bear, I believe. And one of the purposes of these boarding schools was to, as we mentioned, to erase Native languages and Native identity. And so that was one of the poems I wanted to write about. So let me see if I can get that right here. It's called Our Tongues Slapped Into Silence. And there's a section in here that imitates the Dick and Jane reading series. They were very short sentences and very repetitive. So that's in there. And it's called Our Tongues Slapped Into Silence. In first grade, I was 5 years old, the youngest and smallest in my class, always the one in front at group picture time. The principal put me in first grade because I spoke Diné and English. Because of that, I skipped beginner class. All my classmates were Diné, and most of them spoke only the language of our ancestors. My grandmother told me that I was very useful because I interpreted for my classmates. During this time, the government's policy meant to assimilate us into the white way of life. We had no choice in the matter. We had to comply. The taking of our language was a priority. Dick and Jane Subdue the Diné. See father, see mother, see Dick run, see Jane and Sally laugh, oh, 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 see Spot jump, oh, 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 see Eugene speak to Ned, see Juanita answer him, oh, 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 see teacher frown, oh, 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 oh. In first grade, our introduction to Indian school was Miss Rollins, a black woman from Texas, who treated us the way her people had been treated by white people. Later, I learned how difficult it was for black teachers to find jobs in their communities. So they took jobs with the Bureau of Indian Affairs in New Mexico and Arizona in the 1950s and 60s. See Eugene with red hands, shape of ruler. Oh, oh, oh. See Eugene cry. Oh, oh, oh. See Juanita stand in corner, see tears fall down face, oh, oh, oh. Miss Rollins found it difficult to adjust to living in a mostly Diné community, connected to the outside world by only a dirt road that was sometimes impassable in the winter. In first grade, we received the first of our Dick and Jane books that introduced us to the white man's world, through father, mother, Dick, Jane, Puff, and Spot. These and other characters said and did what we thought all white people did, drive cars to the farm, drain maple juice from trees, and say, oh, 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 a lot. Oh, see us draw pictures of brown horses under blue clouds. We color eyes black, hair black. We draw ears and leave out mouth. O-C-C-C-C. Miss Rollins, an alien in our world, stood us in the corner of the classroom or outside in the hallway to feel shame for the crime of speaking Diné. Other times, our hands were imprinted with red slaps from the ruler. In later classes, we headed straight for the rear of classrooms, never asked questions, and never raised our hand. Utter one word of the Diné, and the government made sure our tongues were drowned in the murky waters of assimilation.
Yeah, beautiful. Poem by Lara Tohe, who's our guest on the program today. We'll head toward another break. I just want to read this. This is very powerful. This is, I think, from this No Parole Today. And you write a letter to Richard Henry Pratt, a response. I just want to read part of this. I voice this letter, you say, to you now because I speak for me, no longer invisible, no longer relegated to the quiet margins of American culture, my tongue silenced. To write is powerful and even dangerous. To have no stories is to be an empty person. Writing is a way for me to claim my voice, my heritage, my stories, my culture, my people, and my history. Very powerful. Let's take another break. Come back with our final segment with Lara Tohe on Access Utah. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to be joined today by Lara Tohe, who's a poet, writer, librettist, former Navajo Nation Poet Laureate. She is professor emerita at Arizona State University. Her books include No Parole Today. We just talked about that. And Code Talker Stories. We talked about that earlier in the hour. So, Lara Tohe, I want to talk at least briefly, we're kind of running short on time here, briefly about a very interesting project, 2006, 2007, right? Phoenix Symphony commissioned an oratorio, and you were commissioned to write the libretto for this. Tell me briefly about this.
Yes, I was asked to write the libretto, the words to this oratorio, which is like an opera. I spoke to the composer, Mark Gray, who is my collaborator, and we met by phone, and he explained the project, and he said, you know, would you be willing to work with me to write the libretto for this oratorio? And I said, yes, I would be happy to do that, not knowing what they were. So after we decided we'd meet again, I hung up and I quickly went to the dictionary and looked up libretto and oratorio. And I was still not sure about myself to write something so huge that would be performed before a huge audience in Phoenix. And I asked Mark, the composer, I said, "You, how should I write this?" And all he said was, "Write lines this long," and they were about like 3 inches. He held up his fingers, 3 inches long, write lines that long. So I did that, and still unsure if I was doing this the way I should be doing it, and sent two or three stanzas to Mark, read it, loved it, said, "This is what I'm looking for." So that was a success for me. And I was able to write the libretto, which is about two brothers. One is a brother, and then there's a cousin brother. They go to the war in the Middle East, and one of them gets killed there. The surviving brother has survivor's guilt, comes back with PTSD, and has to go through these various six cycles, where he starts out and moves around in a clockwise direction until he comes back to where he started out from. I was using the Navajo cardinal directions to develop the story. So the east, it starts in the east, and then the story develops to the south, and then west, and then north. And it's about PTSD and healing, and how this young man, this Navajo man, has to try to survive what he experienced in the war. And in my family, as I mentioned, my grandfather was in World War I. My father was a code talker during World War II, and I have two brothers that were in the Army during the Vietnam era, and then my husband also served. So there's whole military family I come from, and I was writing about one of my brothers who did come back with PTSD and did not survive past 40 years of age. So that's essentially what this oratorio was about. It was performed in Phoenix and in Salt Lake and in Colorado.
All right. Let's hear just a little piece of this. I just found this on YouTube. This passage is described as strength and hope is summoned from the sacred mountains. We'll just hear just a bit of this. Enemy Slayer, a Navajo oratorio. Just a little snippet of that. You can find pieces of this. You can purchase that as well, I think, still on the CD and et cetera. About a minute and a half left, Laratohi. Tell me very briefly what you're doing at Zion Canyon Mesa, and then what maybe your latest project.
Yeah. Well, right now I've spent a lot of time looking out the window. this office that I'm at has these windows, and I have a beautiful view of the rocks here. So I brought some work with me that I had started. I'm working on that. I'm also working on some poems on weaving. My family on both sides, my mother and father's side, were all weavers. I don't weave. I have done a few, but I'm a weaver. So I'm trying to get this idea together of what am I doing, excuse me, about trying to get my thoughts together on how I want to put together this work on weaving. Another thing that interests me is also on water, and with global warming at our doorstep practically, where I come from and where I was raised, there was always little water, and now it's even more so. So that's another project I'm working on. I also have a public art project that I'm doing for the city of Albuquerque. I'm working with two other individuals, Nora Naranjo-Morse and Emily. We're putting together this huge installation of a turtle. Actually, it's a tortoise. And there's going to be a light design and my poem on it. And it's going to be posted near the Sandia Mountains. And I believe the deadline is in July, so it's coming up close. And so we'll be doing that as well. So this is what I've been doing for the past 40 years.
Okay.
Just writing and publishing and enjoying it all, and just so grateful to be here. And I've mentioned this to Logan Hebner, who manages the Zion Canyon Mesa. I'm just so grateful to be here and to be part of all this and to have its inspiration towards my creativity.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program today, telling us about a bit of this. So we've been talking with Laura Tohe. You can find her at lauratohe.com. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And thank you very much for inviting me. It was fun.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures, Skywatcher Leo T. Head on out and catch the breeze or the waves, and at dawn, Jupiter, Venus, and Mercury make a line almost straight up that lengthens this week as Jupiter gets higher and both Venus and especially Mercury move lower. Fainter Castor and Pollux from Gemini stand off to Jupiter's side. Quite a sight with your morning chai or coffee or a shot of Carol Ann's in it. See the sky and telescope chart and photos on the Skywatcher Facebook page. On the other side of the day, just after dark, Saturn is the orangest planet, low in the east. But as the evening advances, Saturn gains a companion. Very bluish, formal hot, the autumn star makes its appearance above the southeastern horizon, some three-fifths to Saturn's lower right. If you can get a good horizon to the southeast, it'll make you feel the vast vista between you and the rest of the universe. And a new discovery way out there in the universe from the Green Telescope. It looked live in the sky. This is from a report by Avi Cohen. Astronomers are surprised by a Milky Way molecular cloud holding the mass of 160,000 suns. Now, these are molecules, offering new insights into star formation and galactic evolution. Located approximately 23,000 light years away, this massive structure from the Green Bank Telescope, this cloud nestled within a dusty lane of the galactic bar, a crucial region for material transported to the galaxy's core. This gives scientists a new insight into star formation and galactic evolution. And let's take the little Skywatcher spaceship out, do a little exploring on our own out to join Juicy, not orange juice, but Juice, or Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, which just got a gravitational kick from Venus on August 31st, using the gravity of Venus, Earth, and the Moon to gain extra velocity to arrive at Jupiter in July of 2031, making observations and checking out the probes, instruments as it goes. JUICE will orbit Jupiter for 3 years and then begin orbiting Jupiter's largest moon, Ganymede, as well as checking out the other large icy moons, as JPL NASA scientists hope to find out possible buried oceans of liquid water, which could lead to finding out about habitats for microscopic life. Navigating the seas and the stars and the tropics, just think about it. One Sky, Many Cultures on Skywatcher Leo T. To be able to sail the seas at all is amazing, but to learn about how Pacific Islanders did so across thousands of miles is mind-boggling. In Micronesia, skywatching navigating experts would locate and memorize the shapes and positions of linear star-to-star constellations on an imaginary three-dimensional compass and knew how to identify a chain of stars appearing over the same point of the horizon throughout the night and use that knowledge to steer the boat to a particular island. In order to chart the east-west segments of a course, the people of Oceania used the wind, the ocean currents, and astronomical observations, relying on purely natural forces to hone navigation into a fine art. Imagine being on the infinite, powerful ocean, rising and falling and cresting, and on a pitch-black night with stars and nebula and clusters dripping all around you as you set out on an outrigger boat. The loneliness as you set out to sail for a few hundred miles or more to another island, knowing and reading the currents and adjusting the directional wind changes and gusts and reading the stars above you like a map. The might just ring like a harmonic on a harp, being in complete touch with nature. Skywatcher Leo T is available on Utah Public Radio in Logan, Utah, Utah State University on Thursdays at 9:55 a.m., 7:55 p.m., KZMU Moab, Utah, and on Powerhouse Community Station KRCL Friday evenings, usually at 6:10 p.m., on Sundays at 7:40 a.m., 10:40 a.m., and 2:40 p.m. It is also available on the Garfield and Wayne County Insider newspaper every week and on the Spotify podcast available on the Skywatcher Leo T Facebook page, which features incredible space photos and a short blog. If you want to underwrite or contribute to operational costs, you can contact me directly at skywatcherleot@gmail.com. So keep navigating, feel the currents and the breeze, look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost on the oceans, on Earth, and on space. Skywatcher Leo T.